Communication. Let's get on with this particular subject. Have you ever seen a sentence like that? I know that you believe you understand what you think I said, but I'm not sure that you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. What's the fog count in that sentence? Very high, isn't it? And I think fog count in communication can come from a number of sources. Fog meaning it's difficult to understand. We have difficulty communicating. Let's commit this whole issue of communication to the Lord as we begin, please. Lord, we praise you and thank you for all your love and mercy and grace, for all the things that you've done in us and through us, for your love that overcomes us, even as we pause to think about your great love that caused you to be willing to give your Son for us. Lord, we would thank you for that gift. We rejoice that you continue to love us and for the promises you've made, that you would teach us and instruct us in the way that we should go, that you would guide us with your eye, that you would uphold us with your victorious right hand, that you would never leave us nor forsake us. And on, the promises are so special and so meaningful. And even how you clarify that it's by these promises that we are able to partake of the spiritual life. We thank you for all these things. And we pray that you would take this time now that's been set aside, cause words to be spoken, thoughts to be considered, hearts to be moved, whatever you would choose in this time. We'd ask that you would control everything that's said and done. In Jesus' name, amen. As we begin, I would like you to have a copy of this handout. It'll probably give you some reasonable idea of the approach we'll use throughout the remainder of our time. As we begin with the subject of communication, I would like us to look a little bit at a definition. One definition says that communication is the communicator. That's the person. It's made possible through the medium of the communicator, a living person. The way to establish communication is through the communicator himself or herself. It's through you. You are the source. You're the medium. The way to establish this communication is through you. For the message and the messenger must become one. You've heard it said that if you don't back up what you say with your actions, then people will probably believe what they see as opposed to what they hear. I think that's true, that you and what you say should be one. And not just what you say, it's how you feel about it. The message is incarnate, it's made alive in the messenger. And when that happens, the message is not an idea, it's an event. It's a happening. It's an involvement. And it seems to me that in our computer age that we are trying to substitute the facts are and nothing but the facts. If I just get the facts out, everything will be okay. And you know that's not true. But I think that's the way we're moving. That we're focusing on precise information. Feeling that if we do that, our communication will be effective. Well, as we go through some ideas today, I think that we'll see another view of that. If you would like to see more about that transparency, I'll leave it up here a few minutes after we've concluded. Well, what about the communication? What's our motivation for it? If you would, please, turn to Colossians 4. Colossians 4:6. Let me suggest if you stop by the bookstore and see if they've got a little... I think it's free now. They used to charge 2 cents a page for it. They may give it to you if they have any stock. A little sheet that shows you how to put a ladder on the side of your Bible. Over the years... it saved I don't know how many hours of time. Because with the ladder and you spread it out, you not only can find the book that you're looking for, but you can get within a page or two if you don't have trifocal glasses. If you have trifocal glasses, you're doing good to find the Bible. I was two pages away. I don't know what comes after that. Can you believe I was in the first all-student jet class that the Air Force had? I mean, I could see. But now I'm in trifocals. And I try to see. You know, I go this way. And if that doesn't work, you know, then I have to ask for help. And I'm learning how to do that. It's really good to help destroy your pride. You say, would you help me, please? And then to reach the conclusion, I need all the help I can get. You know, that's where it is. After this, it's a seeing-eye dog. Let's look at Colossians 4, 6. Who has that and would like to read it for us, please? Someone. All right. Did I see someone? Yes, sir, please.
Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned as it were with salt, so that you may know how you should respond to each person.
I don't know if you read the Bible in the first person. It's tempting to read it in the third person. When the Bible says, let you do something, you say, hey, that's great for Billy Graham. Or the battle cry I see today is, here am I, Lord, send George. Or the one that kills me is, here am I, Lord, send my wife. Boy, that is really destructive. I see that going on a lot today. I think a lot of people are resigning the you out of the Bible. I was challenged by the Lord some years ago to try my best to read it in the first person. If I can tell the you is a given person at a given time and doesn't relate to me, then I won't accept that it's probably not directly to me. And if I can't tell that, then I would like to assume that the you probably includes me. So when I read it in the first person, it says, let, what would the word go there? If you, let my conversation. And as you end up, so that I may know how to answer everyone. You see how that takes on a first person? I would challenge you to read the Bible in the first person. If you've never asked God to help you with that, I think the place to start right now is where you're sitting. You have not, why? Because you ask not. See, have you ever asked God to help you to read the Bible in the first person? And if you've never done that, if there's any question about it, I challenge you right now. If you don't get anything but that from this time, I think it'll be a life changer. It certainly is for me. It is changing my life. So I ask, Lord, please help me to read the Bible in the first person. If that you means me, help me to see that it means me. Help me to put it in first person terms. Then the second thing, if anything else comes up in here that you say, well, I don't know that I have that. I don't know that that issue is really in my life. Then I challenge you to pause right then and say, Lord, what I just saw, you call it by name. Put that in my life. Make it real. Make it meaningful. Help me to be able to do that. Work in me and through me to do, get that issue into action so that I'm living out your word. So let's look at this. I wonder how many of us have really prayed this scripture into our life. If not, let's do it at the beginning. I said something like, Lord, please let my conversation. That's my total speech. Not just what I say, but how I behave with what I say. Lord, let my conversation be always full of your grace. That's giving me what I really don't deserve. It's just a free thing that you give me. Give that to me so that my speech is that way, please. And season my speech with salt. I've got a friend say, well, salt has a bite to it. That's not what that means. I don't believe. What is salt really intended for? To bite? To have flavor. And what happens when you have flavor? Tastes better. How much better? A lot better. Sometimes it's the difference between eating it and not eating it, isn't it? Have you ever had something with no salt and you want to go spit that out? You say, well, I'm not sure what it is, but this isn't right. And then somebody said, whoop, forgot to put the salt in. You add salt, and that's not enough. Put in a little bit. Hey, that's just right. And then I know what happens after that. It's the difference between being palatable and acceptable and intaking of it or rejecting it. So just pray that our speech is not only with God's grace, it's seasoned with salt. And I would suggest His salt for Him to put on in our mouth. So that the words that come out will be seasoned with salt, palatable, tasty, easy accepted and digested and responded to on the part of the other person. How is that for a prayer? And then, Lord, give me your answers to everyone that I meet. Help me to know how to answer them. Not only what to say, but the way that I say it. Put the words in my mouth and the meditations in my heart. Speak out through me exactly what you want spoken and no more. And I would put a parenthesis here. And also, Lord, please show me when to shut up and be quiet. That's kind of a tough one, isn't it? Because sometimes communication includes silence, doesn't it? In fact, in speech courses, they have what's called the effective pause. Meaning nothing. It's quiet at that moment. There are some reasons for it. Remember, Jesus was quiet. a number of times, especially when he was being accused. And before his accusers, he simply sat silently there. So, to pray that into your life, Lord, please give me conversation that's always full of your grace. Season my speech with your salt and show me how to answer everyone that I come in contact with. Again, that's a life changer. If you really meant that prayer, and my guess is most of you have not prayed that. It's a pattern I'm still trying to work on, to recognize things in Scripture that I don't have and then be willing to ask for it. Well, let's take a look at some of the issues involved in communication. I think the way to do that is to use a diagram that you have now on that one-page handout. We're going to kind of develop that as we go along. And you see the issues that are described there. We have the communication process as a block diagram. We have a sender on this side. We have a receiver on this side. Now, what does the light bulb imply? An idea. That's a false identification to start with, because almost all of us accept the light bulb as an idea. There's much more than just the idea. It's how you feel about the idea. We'll talk more about that as we go along. So you have an idea and some response inside to the idea. Then you as a sender have to go through some personal barriers. These would be your own. There is a message. There's physical barriers that frequently have to be overcome. You have to use a channel, one or more of our senses, get through a second set of barriers into the receiver. And all the time that this is happening, there's a feedback circuit that the receiver is responding through his barriers or her barriers through a channel. The same type of process. We have to return the signal. Now, that feedback could be a shake of the head. It could be a look at your watch. I don't know what it might be. It could be a clipping your pen, depending on how nervous it's making you. There's a lot of things that could happen in the way of feedback. But you know that feedback does occur. I think with communication that it's a little bit like it is in psychology. Psychologists teach us that it's impossible to have zero behavior because zero behavior is a type of behavior. Does that make any sense? It doesn't really make all that much sense to me. But I think the idea that exhibiting no behavior is a type that they label no behavior. A zero communication is a no communication. It's communicating something. Have you ever said something and the person is just silent? And you say, well, say something. I mean, tell me, why? Give me some clues. That's what we want, is some feedback. What are we really trying to do? Well, it's an oversimplification. But I think we should begin, if we are the sender, we should begin with some type of goal. That's a thing that we really want to achieve. Let's don't have so much idle chatter, but have something meaningful in mind, a goal that we want to achieve. And that goal probably, next time I read that I do this transparency over, I'm going to change this word, if you would, mark it out and put response. Reaction has a negative ring to it. Response is a better word. That you have a goal, and what you really want is a response over here on the part of the receiver. Not just that they understand, but some kind of response. Them to act or not act or agree or disagree or feel or not feel or whatever. It's more than just getting the idea. You want a response. Then the process that we use, we might call the action or the exercise of the communication process. And I think if we look at a few of these key elements, that it will strengthen our ability in communicating. And as we work on them and practice and look for feedback, solicit it. Ask the person, it seems as though that the comment I made caused, and you might describe it, would you explain that to me? How many times? And I'm a learner. I'm not accusing them, why did you act that way? No, I want to know what it was that I said or did or didn't say or do that caused that response. And it's amazing what an education you'll get if you ask questions. So that's then an oversimplification of the process, but I think it's one that might be meaningful for us. Let's begin with by looking at some barriers. And I've taken the liberty to take the notes for you because it's kind of a busy transparency. I don't know a better way to do it because there's so much information here we need to look at. Why would there be two sets of barriers? The two people. Do any two of us have the same set? Even if you were raised in the same family? Especially if you were raised in the same family. Have you noticed how much friction and tension there is in the simple process of communicating? and someone that you live in a close relationship with, like the family. Yeah, you notice that. My wife came downstairs the other day, and I really think my wife's a lovely lady. And I said, goodness, you look lovely today. And she said, today? I said, how did I possibly goof that one up? You know, the communication process is difficult because, first off, we have to start that there are barriers to communication. By knowing the barriers then and working on them, we can change it. As is stated here, they are barriers. Hopefully a little later we'll look at how to make that a little bit more positive. Let's consider a few of these, and I'm going to select the focus on the barriers of the receiver. Please excuse me. I'm limited on how far I can go and not go to get in or out of your way, so I'm pretty well have to stay here, and I can't dodge to give you a little more room to look. If you would focus then on the personal barriers of the receiver, why would I suggest a prime focus on the receiver? Well, it can shut you off. Yeah, if this is your objective to get across, then we have to make a focus there because the receiver can shut us off. Then the next question, obviously, is what shuts the receiver off? Then if we understand what does, then make our focus on those issues, I think it would improve our communication ability. Would you agree to that? That sounds reasonable. Focus on the receiver's communicative skill. Suppose you don't know that. You don't know what the skill level is. How are you going to find out? Well, you have to test it. I certainly will agree with that. How do you go about testing it? Now, we had a little interaction earlier today. Started a conversation. And one thing that I got tracking on was the nuclear power generation. I was finding out, what do you do? And you told me, then I gave a little piece of information, and then you capitalized on the piece of information and showed me very clearly that you had lots of information about that. And I concluded, much more than I do, that his communicative skill in the area of nuclear engineering was significantly higher than mine. But it was a gentle question, and then I answered, then some interaction between the two of us. The starting point, I would suggest, is, as you said, start a conversation, begin with something. How will you find out what to begin with? Ma'am?
Where are you from?
Well, that's an easy one, isn't it? Most of us can tell that one. And what else might you want to know?
What do you do?
What do you do? And then what? Anything else that comes to mind? My dad said, son, pay attention. What he meant by that was observe what's going on in the world around about you. Look and listen and keep up. I've tried that. It's been amazing to me over the years how much information I picked up just trying to follow that little guidance that my dad gave. Look what someone is doing, what they have in their hands, how they are responding to whatever. Pick up on what's going on. It's amazing how you can capitalize on that. Can also not only start a conversation, you might find a good avenue to share the gospel. You might develop a new friendship. You might, I don't know where it might lead. Suppose after a conversation and you've asked some questions, how do you say, I think I know pretty well what their level is, but I'm not sure. I'm going to now begin my communication. I ask the question frequently, would you talk down below their, what you perceive their level to be? Or a little above what you perceive their level to be, if you weren't sure. Most people say below because you're trying to get the idea across. But if you're going to focus over here on the receiver as a person, think about that a minute now. What happens to the receiver if you talk down to them? How do they feel? Yeah. Wow, the person's talking down to me. Must think I'm not very bright. Or that I don't have, my intelligence level is low. Or that I don't have an ability. I think if it's, you don't want to go real high either way, but most people, if you talk above them and they're interested in responding and you bring up a term, they don't understand, they'll probably call you and say, well, what do you mean by that? And then you can tell, okay, I'm a little higher, I'll bring it down now, and then try to find the level that way. If you start by talking down, you may shut the machinery off. It's a kind of a fine point. Now, if somebody's life depends on the accuracy of the communication, or it's an emergency, then I'd say talk down. Make the message as simple as possible. But most of our conversation is not that way, and that's really not the base of what we're saying here in communicating. Values. When you talk to someone who has a different value system than you have, how do you handle it? They're humanists. They're committed to the world. How do you handle that? Argue with them over the value? See, I think that the suggestion here is be careful you don't violate their value system. You don't have to agree with it. I've even said, hey, I've heard that before. You know, and I try to smile. Not saying that, nothing more to that. I'm not saying I agree to that. I just say, well, I've heard that. And suppose I haven't. Well, then I say, I've never heard that before. That's about as far as I'll go with it. I'll allow them to lay their value system on me and try not to be offensive and rude. I have even traded it off. I said, well, it seems as though that your view is significantly different from mine. Tell you what, I would like to have a conversation about that issue. Why don't you go first and tell me everything that you think is significant about that you view? And I'll interact to make sure I've understood what you said. And then when you've finished, let me share mine. Isn't that the good old American way? Most people buy into that. That's a lot better chance to establish some communication and say, hey, man, listen, this humanism is from the pit. That is from nowhere. See, that's what I really believe. I'm willing to shout that from the rooftop, but I don't want to offend the guy at the outset with it. I'm not going to believe what he said. One person said, you seem closed-minded about that. I said, I'm as closed as I can be about it. I found out what the Bible says about it, and it's sealed forever. But, you know, he had to press me to get down to that. Values. If you violate someone's value system, what happens to the communication? I mean, like now. Boy, it cuts off. You were saying earlier, boy, that's why we have to focus over here, to keep from cutting it off. Knowledge and experience go hand in glove. You've seen that. You know something about the issue, but have you had experience with it? I remember my latest episode of going to school, and I'm praying that my school going is over. You know, I started when I was 5, and I didn't finish till 74. But in the school going exercise, I noticed that there's a lot of knowledge given, but a lot of it's not based upon experience. Have you noticed that? So here I am, an older guy, much older guy, going back into school that my professors and I were about the same age. Several of them, I was older than they were. And one professor was laying out this beautiful model up there. And I interrupted him, sir, have you ever done that? Well, no. Have you ever used it in life? Well, no. But Dr. Schmo, I said, no, I was interested if you'd ever done it. It's evident that Dr. Schmo is not. I said, there's a significant flaw in the application of that. Well, you know, it was written in a book. I said, but the man never did it. I know that he didn't, or he would have seen that error. And then the professors, of course, I try not to be argumentative. The statement was argumentative to start with. I said, if I could borrow the chalk, please, sir. You know, in a doctoral program, if you can't offer an idea. So I went up there, and I drew a visual. And I put the chalk down. I didn't have to say a word. I came and sat down. He looked at that, and the whole class looked at it. That's 100% evident. Professor said, yeah, Bill, you're right. That model's an error. He went up there and changed the model. After the class was over, a friend of mine said, Bill, you really won that battle, but you just might have lost the war. Because grade time was coming, see. That was a form of class that I had to get a grade, and this guy's teaching it. Then I got a little nervous, you know. Maybe my communication was out of order. He gave me a solid A. He was kind of a preaching agnostic. And married to a Mormon. That's inverted flight. You know, you roll it upside down, you have a hard time. All the controls reverse. It's really a bad way. It's hard to exist that way. But he gave me the privilege to spark. That may not have been the wisest thing, but I noticed in that experience that knowledge and experience need to go hand in glove. Do you know about a thing? You may have information but never done it. Well, when you find someone who's done it, what's the suggestion there? You've only have knowledge about it, but they have experience. Capitalize on it. What does that feel like? What do you think are the significant factors? You start asking questions, boy, the communication strengthens up, doesn't it? And try to select things that people, that the receiver does have a knowledge and experience about. Focus on his or her knowledge and experience. Now, attitudes, I'm going to swing over here. I think we need to start with our own attitude. If our attitude is belligerent or prideful or arrogant or any of such a list of terms, what happens to the receiver? Again, he cuts it off. If our attitude is not one of love and acceptance, I remember my daughter spoke to me some years ago. She was with me on campus. In fact, we were schoolmates, not classmates, but schoolmates. That means we were both in school at the same time. So I'd met this hippie. He was first class. I mean, you know, had the uniform on. His hair was long and stringy and dirty. And they were really in uniform. I was a military officer for part of that time, and I had a lot more freedom in what I wore than those troops did. I mean, they had to toe the line. I asked one, I said, suppose you cut your hair and went in with the crew tonight. How would they treat you? Well, he wouldn't even think about that. So, you know, we were interacting, and after it's over, my daughter said, Daddy, you know, you acted like you didn't even like that guy. I thought about that. I said, well, I didn't like his clothes, and I didn't like his smell, and I didn't like his attitude, and I didn't like his value system, and I guess I didn't like him. She said, well, that really showed. My attitude was bad. And it showed to everybody's understanding. And I'm so thankful that my daughter pointed that out. Now, she did that in love. And I know she really cares for me, and she's still doing that, trying to point out things to help me. And we do this to one another. You see, we're trying to be helpful. Just talked to her yesterday. She was very helpful for me. So I've had to fall back on my prayer time and say, Lord, I confess. I didn't love that guy. I didn't even like him. Then I rejected him, Lord, and that was sin on my part, and I confess it. A fellow asked me some years ago, showed me something in the Bible, said, read that. I read it. He said, are you doing that? And I told me to do a thing. I said, no, I'm not. He said, what do you call the fact that you're not doing it? I said, well, disobedience. He said, what do you call disobedience? I hung my head and I said, sin. He said, louder. I said, sin. He said, louder. I said, sin. He said, well, now you're beginning to treat the term like you might know what it means. And he said, now that you understand what it means, what are you planning to do about that? You know, this guy really loves me. He's my spiritual dad. He's still doing that to me. I told him one day, I said, you know, it seems like how many times I get around with you, the sword is inserted up under my bottom rib cage, the sword of the word. He opens up the Bible. He said, well, one thing about the sword, several things about a sword, it was designed to shed blood, but it's a sterile type of instrument in the Lord's hands. It will not become infected. And that God will do with his word whatever he pleases. That's a promise. Isn't that exciting to think about that? Start with my attitude. When I recognize an attitude out of order, what should I do? What's the first thing I should do? Confess it as sin. And then what? That's right. Ask the Lord's forgiveness. And then I think it's more than an act of my will. I've got a friend who said, anything the Bible commands you can do by simple act of your will. Something's wrong with that statement. First time I heard it, and I was very, very young in my spiritual walk, intuitively I was aware something was wrong with that. And what's wrong is God said, in everything except whatever. No, he said in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. In everything, pray, right? So at least I know I need to pray. You know how I pray about one like that? It's help. I don't know how you feel about it. My youngest daughter taught that to me some years ago. She disobeyed and, oh, I had to suck up and we're going to go back and take care of that. And we did. And then that night, I put her to bed and we're having a prayer time. She was about 6 or 7. I said, honey, you want me to pray or you want to pray tonight? She said, no, Daddy. Daddy, I'll pray. And she paused. God, I'm sorry. Help me not to do it anymore. And when she cried out for help, I teared up. I said, here's a 6-year-old who's pleading with God. Help. Not just a casual request. Oh, Lord, help me if you feel like it, if it works out. No, Lord, please, help. My attitude is bad. I need to get this thing corrected. Change my life by the power of your Spirit. I'm not doing well by myself, and God never intended for you to do this by yourself. One of the strongest aspects of the Christian life is the Holy Spirit within our lives. I believe that. Physical senses. Does it make any difference about physical senses? I've already admitted that this over here on my left side, I thought I heard that with my right ear, and my left ear wasn't giving me that good a signal, so I don't hear that well. If you ever talk to someone and they didn't respond, if you'd have been behind me like a couple of three paces over there and spoke real softly, I might have ignored you. It's likely I wouldn't have heard you. I went into a classroom one time, the foyer of a building at the University of Tennessee, and there were two people there, two men. Well, I don't know that, but I did learn the fingerspell in the Boy Scouts. I said, well, let's see now. They have a deaf ed department. That could be two students practicing. They could be two deaf students because we've got a lot of deaf students. It could be a deaf person and an interpreter. So I really wasn't sure. I walked in, I looked at them, they saw me, and I said, H-I. I said, and smiled. Gave a little nonverbal reinforcement. One guy said, right back. The other guy said, oh, can you communicate with the deaf? Of course, then I figured out, which was which. and I said, well, I learned the fingerspell. And then he introduced me. And I told the man that I'm B-I-L-L. And he spelled his name out. We shook hands. We became friends. He was in the same doctoral program I was. The only thing wrong with that man that I could find out was that he couldn't hear. I mean, he was brilliant. He could read and understand and take the tests and write the papers, everything, but he couldn't hear anything. I mean, he was absolutely deaf. He asked me to be his interpreter. Let that other guy go. He could read my lips, believe it or not. He must have had grits in his mouth, too. But the fact that we could communicate, and then I could fingerspell, and we could write. I even gave comments for him. One day, after class, we'd become really good friends. I had won his heart, and he had won mine. We were honest-to-goodness friends. And I told him that I wanted to say something. Could he stay behind? And we got the room quiet and closed the door, and we're talking. Then I said, G-O-D-L-O-V-E-S-U. He said, no, that. I said, I know that. H-O-W. Do you know? How do you know that? He said, the first time I touched you to get your attention, you did not back off from me. Everybody backs off if I touch them. Did you get that message? It's called the space envelope. The distance between people that you're comfortable with. Some people make you uncomfortable, you increase the space envelope. If you're loving and sensitive and responding, you decrease the space envelope. He knew that everybody increased the space envelope if he touched them. But he said, I didn't. That's how he knew I loved him. And then I told him I love God. He said, I know that. How do you know that? He said, most lives this way. Up, down. Send you this way. So I got a good hearing for the gospel. I used a little penny illustration and I challenged Jerome to pass that penny on. I think the idea that being aware of physical senses, do people see, can they hear? Maybe they have palsy. You know, they may have any numbers of things. Don't be too quick to jump on that. Something came up the other day, and I asked, do you have a neck problem? The person said, well, yes, I was in an accident. They carried their head high. My job was helping them with the critique and their communication. It was a three-day program, so, you know, we could talk a lot about nonverbal. Physical condition, are you sick? Are you real tired? Are you emotionally wiped out? There's a lot of things to go on. We need to be sensitive to that and not make false assumptions. ask more questions. Instead of saying, hey, you're snooty and stuck up because you carry your nose high all the time. Do you feel that way about some people? We may talk more about that later, but sometimes they have a neck problem. If you knew that, it would alter your feelings. Of course, semantics and verbalisms, words, words, words. And the truth is that from 40 up to 80% of the impact of communication comes from the nonverbal. It's half or more. It wasn't as much what you said as it was the way that you said it. Have you seen two people saying the same thing essentially? One person, people respond to. And the other person said almost the identical words and people didn't respond. And that person says, well, all I said was, and they quote the words, and if you wrote them down, yes, those were the words, but that's not the way it was said. I'm trying to help a fellow here, one of our own, that had had two or three of the people, young ladies that worked for him at one time in tears. And he didn't understand that. And I said, well, one thing that I've observed is the use of the word why. I said, when you're looking for why, are you looking for information? He said, absolutely. I said, you're not trying to accuse them. He said, no. And I said, let me show you how it comes on. Why did you do that? Why did you do that? I said, that's an accusation. I feel some kind of an obligation not to answer why, but to defend myself. And I know that's not right on either of our count. Then he said, how else would you ask why? And I said, well, there's an illustration. So you gave me the second one. I said, let's see if I could demonstrate an alternative. I said, look that person in the eye and smile. Say, it would help me to understand this problem if I understood why. What prompted you to make that decision? Now, isn't that a lot more gentle? Isn't that a lot less threatening? Why did you do that? So we've got a lot going on here. Words alone may not get the message. We've got to back this up with something besides just words. That the facts are and nothing but the facts. That's an awful sterile environment. It's not very well received. Whose interests do we need to focus on to be most effective? Again, on the receivers. How can you focus on it? What do you even find out about their interests? How can you do that? You can ask questions. Yeah, that's one of the best ways. And then again, observe. A friend of mine, in fact, he's here now working for Hewlett-Packard. We were both on active duty at the time many years ago in Alabama. I was discipling him. I'd led him to Christ, and the Lord was doing a significant work in his life. He had never been in any evangelistic thrust. He was scared to death. I said, I know how that is. I said, what you need to do is pray for me, pray for the other person, and at some point in time, if I ask you for your testimony, would you be willing to give it? How you have gotten Jesus into your life? He said, oh yeah, I can do those. I said, that's all I'm asking you to do. I'll carry the ball this time. I'll wield the sword. So we went out and we looked around here and there, and a guy came in. He was dressed in jogging clothes, and in those days, jogging was not quite as popular as it is. Now, this guy's into it, you know, the shirt and it matched, and even the jogging shoes were the right color. I mean, he had really gone into this. Had his little bag with everything in it. I said, oh, are you interested in track? He said, I love it. I said, well, did you know that the Southeastern Conference is having a track meet here in Montgomery this week? He said, yeah, I read about that. I said, who are you picking? Well, he told me, and I said, well, the paper seemed to indicate Florida and Tennessee as the favorites. You know, and we had a little conversation. In a few minutes, I was able to lead over to spiritual things, and I shared the gospel with him. After it's over, my friend said, I didn't know you liked track. I said, me? Oh, man, I don't like track. I have zero interest in track. You know, team sports, but not track. Not where you run by yourself. And he said, well, you sure acted like you were interested in it. I said, Bob, I don't think you understand. He was interested in track, and I'm interested in him. I am so interested in him that I am interested in track. You see? That's different, isn't it? I'd a whole lot rather talk about fishing. That's what I wanted to talk about. See, I'm a committed fisherman. You knew that was biblical. You did. You didn't know that? In Genesis 1, huh? The first chapter of the Bible, God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness and let them have dominion over the what? The fish of the sea. And he goes on. Of course, I didn't get any further than the fish coming. I said, yes, sir. Oh, boy. Man, and some people say, well, that's in the Old Testament. I said, it's in the New Testament, too. Jesus said, follow me and I'll make you fishermen. Not quite. Fishers of men. But then the New Testament application is in Acts. After Jesus had been crucified, the apostles and believers are wringing their hands. Woe is us. They hadn't been resurrected. They didn't know what in the world to do. And what did Peter say? Let's go fishing. Yes, sir. I said, So we got the directive in the Old Testament. We got the application in the New Testament. See, I told you that was biblical. Now, emotions are an integral part of communication. Would you believe this statement? Most people are more interested in how you feel about what you say than they are in what you say. That's been pretty well substantiated by research. Most people are more interested in how you feel about what you say than they are in just the words that you say. Emotions really affect our communication. And it's amazing how poor we are at progressing through emotions. In fact, if it's a highly emotional exercise, you may need to give a little time for it to quieten down. If a person's really upset. A young lady came in my office some months ago, and she had called me up because she'd come talk to me, and I said, well, yes, come on in. We shut the door. You know, after some establishing a little rapport and offering her some coffee, and I was as calm and relaxed as I could, I said, well, how can I help you? And she immediately burst into tears. Oh, started sobbing. And then she said, oh, I'm so sorry, I cried. And I said, wait a minute. Don't be sorry to me that you cried. I said, let me show you how prepared I am. I pulled out my desk drawer and I put a box of Kleenex right there. I said, you can cry all you want to. All you want to, and you are not Lord in my eyes one bit. Did you know it's an Americanism today? It has been for many years that men never cry. Did you believe that? I grew up with that. Boy, you get sapped and you've broken your arm and third degree burn on your foot, you do not cry. You scream inside, but you don't cry. 15 years old, you know, I had the third degree burn and we're pulling at that stuff and I just got my foot propped up there looking at that man. Inside, I'm screaming. But men don't cry. Is that biblical? No, it's not. I don't believe we need to live in a state of emotionalism as a way of life. But we have emotions and they're genuine. And if something has really touched you, see, at Lazarus's tomb, what did Jesus do? He wept. I asked the question, when's the last time you wept for anybody? I mean, even people in our own family, sometimes we don't weep over that. We tend to squelch our emotions, and the people I think pay the heaviest price for this are our sweethearts. And this young lady was a single lady, and she was paying the price. She was feeling extremely guilty that she was crying. And I'm telling her that there's no guilt for that. If that's the way you feel, it's you and me and it's God. That's all that's involved right now. And you can cry all you want to. I said, don't feel bad about that. And when she got over it, I said, you can tell me anytime you want to. I'm willing to listen. If you need more time, we'll take it. So taking the emotional time. And she finally unloaded. Her life was about to collapse on her. She was this far from getting fired from her job. She was trying to do a good job. She had an attitude that was right, but there'd been too much put on her. I simply interceded and went to talk to her boss and said, I really believe if this issue is taken off of her life, that she'll sustain and do an outstanding job. And the boss bought that, took it away from her, and she sustained, and she got married, and, you know, things really worked out. But if I'd have treated her because she had emotions, treated her as a put-down or as a turn-off, see, what turns you off? If it turns you off, you're in all likelihood going to turn them off. And I am not suggesting emotionalism is a way of life. I don't think you can survive in today's world that way. But emotions are genuine. Let's give people the option to have them. They will affect the communication pattern. Now, personal needs. Yeah, water, food, emotions are a personal need. The list is almost endless there. Then there's social and cultural norms, depending on where you are. Case in point, after my dad died, my mother married again. I had two. She got really two outstanding fellas. My dad was just an unbelievably solid, sound man that affected my life so many ways that whenever God said, call me Father, and then went on to say, I will never leave you nor forsake you. My dad would never, there's nothing I could have done that caused him to forsake me. God said, I'll hold you with my victorious right hand. How many times did my dad pick me up? He said, I'll teach you and instruct you in the way that you should go. My dad taught me and showed me. He demonstrated what he said with his life. He said, I'll show you the way. I'll teach you, instruct you. I'll guide you with my eye. My dad was looking over my shoulder all the time. Was available for counsel. Never dominated or controlled my life. Gave me positive inputs. And many of his words rang in my ears, many of which were from the Bible. He didn't know it and I didn't know it. He said, it takes one to know one. I later found out that's 2 Corinthians 1. You know, there's a pattern like that. Social, cultural norms. You develop patterns. You learn it in your family, don't you? And some fellow said, well, my dad wasn't that way. I said, well, then what you'll have to do is read the Bible and find out how he should have been. And then let's turn around and face you. You face up to the fact that how it says in the Bible, that's how you are to be, regardless of how your dad was. Let's don't give him as an excuse, you know, that you read in the Bible, find out. So what a responsibility for fathers. I don't like that. But that's the way it is. Social norms. My mother had married again. And I was down there visiting my mother and stepdad, and they were quite along in years. So I was going to service a car for them, and I'm waiting at the bus stop. This is in St. Petersburg. And I walk up. There was a lady sitting there, and she's obviously, it's on the seat where you wait on the bus. I mean, a big sign. It's evident what's going on. So I walked up, and I said, good morning, ma'am. And she looked at me, and she said, that's awfully forward. I said, what's forward? She said, you spoke to me. I said, yes, ma'am. I said, good morning, ma'am. She said, that's awfully forward. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, where I'm from, people don't speak that way. It's considered forward. I said, where are you from? And she was from Jersey, just across the river from New York. She was in that big maneuver up there. I said, ma'am, you're not in New Jersey anymore. This is Florida. And people in Florida say good morning. You know, you have to be aware of that, because that's liable to happen to you more than once, because Floridians take pride in being friendly. Well, I thought, there's a social cultural norm that I violated. Right? I really did. There's night, there's noise, light, comfort, acoustics, there's any number of physical things. Now, at the moment I snap my fingers, now you listen. At that precise moment, how many of you were consciously aware that the machine's going with the motor? Usually there's somebody. How many of you, there's somebody that usually is. How many have been aware sometime this morning? Yeah, that's most of us. How many of you aware that humming, I think, tell me that humming stopped. Please tell me it has. Because I thought, goodness, I've lost another 15%. Do you know that the Lord loves you anyway? I frequently start off by telling a little story from the fellow that's a nuclear engineer I was mentioning, lived in our home for a while. And after we moved out here, he wrote me a letter. In the body of the letter, he said, Bill, I heard the funniest story. It was so funny, it'll make your hair fall out. And then he put a dash all the way across the page and skipped the line. Said, but I think you've already heard that one. So, you know, I thought about that. And like I told you, I'm in trifocals. And my left knee, my birth certificate says I'll be 59 my next birthday. But my left knee cries, 85! Yeah, at least 85. And my right elbow says, man, I don't know how much longer you can depend on that. I got bone chips in there. And it's looking bad, you know. These are real. I don't know what else comes. But regardless of all that, I know that God loves me anyway. Whether I'm bald or in trifocals or overweight or whatever. There is a comfort and a joy and a peace unspeakable that comes from knowing that I am not on a performance base from anybody for God's love and acceptance. That while I was still deeply involved in the act of sinning, Jesus died for me. That I didn't have to get it right for his payment. He paid for it when I had it wrong. And now that I'm his, all the promises of God come over my way. I'm not on a performance base. He didn't say, I'll never leave you and forsake you provided you do everything I tell you. He didn't say, I'll guide you with my eye, provided you have an IQ of whatever, or that you have hair. Now, there's a tendency in American society for you to put yourself on a performance base for your own self-worth. Have you noticed that? That's the way we're organized. It's a competitive society. It is not cooperative. To be cooperative, you look strange in today's world. Then there are other people who assign worth to you based upon your performance. Have you noticed that? You have on the job. You say, well, that's the way it is on the job. Yeah, that's the way it is, but that's not the way it ought to be. Because as a child of God, you are infinitely worth. Your worth is, that's where your self-worth is. It's who am I in God. So I think that's an issue that if that's not really grasp your soul, then I challenge you where you're sitting. Lord, please grasp me with a deep-rooted truth that you love me no matter what. That there's no power on earth who can separate me, which can separate me from God's love. The Bible says that. Do you believe it? Now, if you believe it and it hasn't grasped your soul, ask now that that will forever grasp your soul, that you will never, ever entertain that as a doubt anymore. That any time a situation comes up that you're doubting your own worth or someone else is doubting your worth, you just remind yourself, well, God, you told me. Boy, the promises of God, to memorize some of those. Talk about undergirding and strengthening and joy and peace.
Do you have any marking? I was going to try to show you a model of how communication is based on all our goals that we ever have and think about.
I've got a marker, and I'll try to save a few minutes at the end. Can we do that? Remind me, you got to watch. Will you tell me at 25 after and see if I can stop close to that? I'd like to give you the time, please, sir. That noise, light, comfort, acoustics, all things that could interrupt us, we need to be aware of. Yes, sir. I would say it works for both. This may be hard to believe, but I say that it works for both. It's primarily based on an individual to individual. But I think you can find it will also be effective in a group. That if I know what the group norm is, assuming that it's a homogeneous grouping. Now, if it isn't, knowing that tells you, you can see then that you've got extraneous things on the side here, many to consider. It's going to make it more difficult. The same issues have to be considered with a group that you do with one-to-one. That's my opinion. And I've taught this basic model at Air University for a number of years. And then as a management training consultant, most recently last week with Hewlett Packard. And I found that it works in model. And I've seen it practiced one-to-one, a person giving a performance, an active communication pattern to a group and having it evaluated at the end, at least critiqued, 1,500 times, literally. So I've seen it in action. I've also seen when these basic principles are violated, what happens to the communication. Doesn't matter how precise the wording was. If the nonverbal didn't support it, it's collapse. I also taught some counseling seminars, and what is interesting in there, a technique I used was to have a counselee who had a problem assigned. It was role-playing. Then I selected three or four students out of the class to be counselors, and I excused the counselors to go to coffee while we reviewed with the counselee how he was supposed to think and feel. And then we had a video camera looking in. The same counselee came to four different counselors with the same problem and then replayed the sessions. You want to see how your communication affected him? Great day was that enlightening. Then we transitioned from the knowing to the doing. And that's what I was saying a little earlier, that the knowledge about may not be enough to carry you. You need to practice and experience and then finding out where did it collapse. Knowing the model is not enough. The model is just a little basic thing. I think it's not only practicing and experiencing it, it's the heart change that needs to go with it. Let's look at some things. I said that these were personal barriers. And I think that they are if we don't understand them or if we don't use them, if we experience them and don't respond to them effectively. Let's take the thought pattern now. Suppose we do understand communicative skill and knowledge and experience and a number of these things. There should be an et cetera, incidentally, down here on both sides. Et cetera, meaning the list is very long. But assuming we do use these and use them effectively, then they're no longer barriers. They're something else. They're something positive. I don't know a good title for them, but one thing that strikes me is that I probably would call them a perception patterns or patterns of perception. They allow me to perceive the other person. If I know their knowledge and experience and their values, then I have an understanding more about the person. And if you would like to put a plus right here and put a minus by barriers, and above that put a plus and put perception or perceive the person is plus if you use them. Let's talk a little bit about the positive aspect of that. I kind of overshot one before I got to that. And that is that we do need to give some consideration here to the message. We said it was ideas, but feelings. It's not only what you say about it, it's how you feel about it. And the demonstration so that people can tell how you feel. I think that's an issue you'll find that people have a driving desire to know. I give you an illustration of that. Some years ago I had some of our own here, the managers at the Glen. And I gave a little seminar. We were going to make it longer than this, several days. And I had the people in the tables arranged in a U. And the chairs were around it. There were 13 people in that seminar. And one man was very precise, methodical. He was trained in engineering and math, and that was a pattern you would expect. But I think he had practiced kind of squelching his own feelings. And I brought up a word. I walked right up in front of him in the U, and I said the word. I said, "How do you feel about that? Now, what do you think about it? How do you feel about it?" He didn't know how to respond to the question. "What do you mean, how do I feel?" I said, "Well, do you like it? Do you love it? Do you hate it? Does it excite you? Does it depress you? How do you feel about it?" And he looked at me and he said, "I like it." I said, "No more communication." We started around. I said, 1 to 10. Now, 10 is the greatest thing in his life. Pick a number. And it went 2, 3, and 4. Till we got around to one guy who said 8. The next to the end over here said 8. Then I could have stopped him and said 8. If I'd have done that, how much more honesty would I get from anybody on what number they chose? You see, I could have wiped the whole thing out. I could have just frowned at him. My nonverbal would have cut him off and everybody else in the room. I finished and I said, "Well, I'm going to show an alternate way to address that 8, see. Instead of saying 8, I smiled at him, walked over his way, had a little personal interaction. I said, "Well, it's evident that the number you selected was significantly higher than the mean. Now, what prompted you to select 8? And wasn't that more gentle? Yeah, he's responding. He said, "Well, I know the guy, and I know pretty well how he thinks about it, how he feels about it." I said, "That's a great answer." Then I turned to the man. I said, "You're the only one who has the keyed response. What is the correct?" He said, 7. I said, "It should startle you to realize we don't believe you." And I was trying to say something to jolt him. Then at the next break, I told him, "No, that's true. That we didn't, as a group, didn't believe you. And I'm not sure we believe you now, even though you said there's 7. If you'd be interested, I'll be glad to show you visually why we felt that you didn't. Because I'll use some video equipment to let you see it." Well, he followed up on that. And then some months later, his wife told him that he had really changed because he was beginning to work on giving some nonverbal feedback. You know, he's not the world's greatest. That wasn't the objective. The objective was to try to help some. So, ideas and feelings. And, of course, one or more of our senses. We rely primarily on the hearing channel. And I'm going to submit that the visual channel is probably more effective. Of the things you've learned in your life, some recent research has indicated that roughly 83% you learn through your eyes. About 11% through your ears, and that's one reason I think elementary teachers have show and tell. If you see it and hear it. Now, that's for what you learn, but look about recall if it's something new. If you only heard it, 70% after 3 hours. If you saw it, it's not that much difference. You didn't hear, you only saw it, 72%. But if you saw it and heard it, 85% recall after 3 hours to me is significant. But let's look at it after 3 days. Audio is only 10. Visual only is 20. But audio visual is 65%. That is 6 orders of magnitude greater than if you only heard it. Why do we persist in the hearing channel only? It's amazing. The school system is, you know, unequivocally obligated and committed to the hearing. Now, I've been in one or two schools that weren't. I remember in pilot training, they would give you some They give you some information, but then they would show you a lot. And of course, the motivation was different. I remember going over the archway to go into the first operations room. From there, you go out to the aircraft. They had over the archway, and big letters said, "What you don't know won't hurt you." And then you went through. They had a little tiny plaque that said, "It'll kill you." I said, you know, here's a country lad from a small town. I'm looking at that. It'll kill me. I thought, you know, I believe that guy is right. I think I'm going to pay attention, not just to what he says, but what I'm supposed to do. Then you make a mistake, then what happens? I remember one time I nearly killed myself and the instructor. We had just transitioned out of propellers into jets. That's quite a transition. All we had was a dollar ride. I mean, three times around the landing pattern, he's going to give me this multi-million-dollar airplane. I'm nervous. But he's in there with me, and I overshot. I did a thing I learned to do in propellers. I just kissed bottom rudder on the turn, and it's called a slip. You're supposed to slip a little bit, kind of slide in. I lost 500 feet before I could get my foot off the dumb thing. You know, he's gasping for breath back there, and I'm gasping for breath, and he says, "I guess I don't have to tell you not to do that anymore." I said, "Sir, I will never, ever do that. As long as I live, it's indelibly etched in my memory. You know, the seeing and the doing of it is so permanent." Now, let's talk a little bit about using these barriers and assume that we use them and use them effectively. Then they become a perception base, and everything takes on a different perspective. Let me, as an illustration now, let me give you a one-question test, and you select the key response. Read the question and select the response you think most closely answers the question. Okay, has everybody got an answer now? What's the key response? The yo-yo. How many feel it's number two? That's an electric yo-yo. See that thing turn on? Yeah. Hey, I love it. I can hardly stop once I get started. So obviously everybody's wrong but me. I need the light bulb. The battery's essential. I've got to have wire to connect it. The yo-yo is my subject. It's the plug that I don't need. It's a shame all of you are wrong but me. Have you ever run into people who are that way in their communication pattern and their base of perception? You know, everybody's out of step but the commander. Well, that happens to be true. See, that's a written regulation. That's how that one got established. For any other case, I don't believe it's true. But we persist with it. You can see the perception. You were perceiving what? The issues that went together. The yo-yo looked like it was the one that didn't match. You say, well, what I need then is clear-cut statement without all that. Okay, here's the one sentence, clear-cut statement. What I'd like you to do with this sentence is count the number of times the letter F, A, B, C, D, E, F, the number of times the letter F appears in the sentence. Got it? Two constraints, one time through. Don't do it twice. And secondly, do it quickly. I'd like to see how fast you can do it. And then when you've finished counting them, look over at me. Okay, somebody's through. Several are through. Several people are through. Is everybody through? No, there's a couple of people that aren't. I'm going to turn it off in the middle here because you're not going very fast. How many of you found two? There really were two, but how many of you found three? Yeah, there are honestly three. How many of you found four? There are four. How many found five? There are five. How many found six? There are six. How many found seven? There's only six. I think. Now, those who found two, how many F's are ineffective? Obviously, two, right? And threes, the ones who selected threes, there's obviously an F in life. Where do the other F's come in? One, two, where's the third one? Here's the result. Two, three. Now, you see, you just gave me the title of this transparency. It's called, That's the name. A-H-H-H-H-H, You say, well, you know, I was tricked. Did I trick you? I thought I told you, A, B, C, D, E, F. And then I gave, that's in sign language, that's the letter F. I did everything I could do. If we'd had a chalkboard, I'd have written it on a chalkboard. You were being ornery. You didn't want to count. No, that's not what it was. Well, why didn't you count all the F's and R's? Sound like these. And there's one, probably one out of 25 that has a phonetic response to the letter F. That's true. Then the rest of you who don't have that, why didn't you count them? You didn't read it. Why didn't you read it? And what's with the OF anyway as a word? How valuable is it? You just kind of skip it. Weren't you taught to kind of skip it? What's the effective manager, result, years, training, experience, life situation. Isn't that pretty well the message? Isn't that what you read for? You don't read for the obs. Who in the world reads for the obs? Even if I ask you to do it, you didn't do it, see? And you're just so typical. Now, if I've only got five people in a class, I can't get all the spread. But see, this is the first time we've ever had seven. I'll have to admit that. But we've had six a number of times, but not very often. How about that? Not very often do we have six. And why is it that we don't have six? Because we've been trained that the F's and of are unimportant. It's a pattern of our perception. We perceive that they don't count. It's how we look at it. See, the way we look at a thing will determine how we respond to it. And even if I try to set the stage and tell you ahead of time that's what we're trying to do, our own background and our training, our knowledge, our experience, and our everything else, we come one more time to the conclusion that it's holding up our response in the communication. Our response was to count, and we didn't count effectively because you say, well, what I want is something real simple. Then we won't have any problems with it. Well, the teacher, spot is a dog, run, spot, run, she calls on the little guy to recite. And he says, personally, I think the author's style is redundant, repetitive, and lacking in narrative skill. You don't really know what's going on in that little guy's mind, do you? You don't really know, even if you make it simple. You say, well, let's stick with the simple. Well, all I want to do is find something that's clear-cut that we can agree upon. How about that? I love fish. So do I. We have a lot in common. Clear communication, right? Agreement. I mean, we're even agreeing. Well, he's thinking about an aquarium. He loves them because he feeds them and changes the water and the rocks and all that. And she's thinking about, hey, this guy wants to take me out to dinner. And I love the fish dinner. Boy, you say, well, what I want then, well, let's get precision. So I turn to the dictionary. This is Webster's Collegiate. Now, don't call it out, but when you recognize it, raise your hand. It's a noun. A polyhedron having for its base a polygon and for faces triangles with a common vertex. You got that? Well, let me help you. Polyhedron is a multi-sided three-dimensional figure. That didn't help a whole lot, did it? Having for its base a polygon, that's a two-sided, two-sided figure. And that's for the bottom. And the faces, the sides of it are triangles that come together. How about that? Does that help? Yeah, I did this some months back, and one guy said, oh, I see it. It's a palm tree. I said, well, if that's what you perceive, then that's what it is. If it's a polyhedron, the word didn't mean anything, then it could have been a tree as easy as anything else. We said that precision doesn't always do it. And some things you just simply cannot describe. I mean, you have to see it. You know what OSHA is? Occupational Safety and Health Administration, part of the government. They have rules on how to make rules. If you did everything that they want done in building a house, you might not get it finished. You know, the whole idea is good, to let's save lives and do things safely, but there has to be an end to some of it. So sometimes that you... Goodness, I didn't realize you all going to be there attached to that transparency. See, I came prepared, though, Z. I came prepared. That is a busy slide, isn't it? I mean, that is really busy. And the further you go with it, the more... You can even get emotional about that. And the people who do are the contractors. Do we have any contractors in the room? A contractor really says, I understand that. I live with that. Yeah. Well, you remember what it was. I mean... I know you believe you understand, but it's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to understand. Now, the nonverbal aspects, we've talked a bit about that. Let's have just a few moments here of demonstration. Now, we won't be able to do a lot because of a limited time, but I'm going to change the set of my jaw 15 or 20 degrees, try to have no facial expression. Now, this is straight ahead. I'm going to lower my jaw, and then I'm going to look at you, and then you tell me how you feel about me. What does it make you feel about me? How am I? Okay, let's try coming into it. How'd that make you feel? Yeah, okay. Now, let's try it with a jaw high. Would you believe that almost every word you use to describe how you probably think I feel or am describe a character trait? That I'm arrogant, that I'm prideful. Do we feel that way when people do this to us? I had a student with George Power Corporation some years ago. They came in, middle managers from all over the state. They didn't know each other. We had to go through a little time getting to know each other. He gave a presentation, and I had it recorded on video, and he just started, and I hit the button, you know, there he is. And I stopped and looked at that, and I let him look, and he looked at me and said, "Do I hold my neck like that?" I said, "Predominantly." I said, "Do you have a neck problem?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Tell me about it." He said, "Was in an automobile accident, and it injured his neck, and feels better to do this." I said, "Can you bring it? Try bringing it down." He brought it down. I said, "Does it hurt?" He said, "Well, just a little bit." I said, "I think you've given into it over the years. I would suggest, for the sake of low pain, that if you want to establish a relationship more effectively, when you first meet somebody, bring the jaw down and smile, look them right in the eye and shake their hand. And let them see friendliness, that you're not these other things." I said, "What does it make you feel like?" He said, "Well, it makes me look like I'm conceited and stuck up." I said, "Well, that's what the jaw high frequently does." And then he stopped and thought. He said, "That might be one of the reasons I'm having difficulty being accepted by the other men here. I feel that they haven't quite let me in." So then when we had the critique, we covered that. And to the group, they knew then that he had a neck problem, and that just knowing that did a lot to change it. Then there's another issue. Now, I'm going to try not to forget the last few minutes here. Who's about 5'8 in here? Anybody? A man that's about 5'8. How tall are you? 5'6. It's about time for you to bail out, though, isn't it? Could you help me with a thing before you go, please? If you would, Ben, come stand over here and just look toward me with your hands by your side. Now, the setting is that we're in the downtown in one of the malls. And we're acquaintances. We're not real close, but we've known each other over the years. And I see him, and I said, "Hi, Ben.
Hi, Bill.
What's wrong with this?" Okay, now you stay still, and don't pay attention to him. I'm going to walk, and I'm going to speak slowly and speak softly and come slowly. And when I get to when you're comfortable in the distance, you say, "Stop," and I'll stop. I'll just come slow. Don't pay attention to him. When it feels right for you, you just, okay, shook his head. The space envelope among American males of approximately the same height is normally an arm's length and 4 to 6 inches. Stick your arm straight out. Do you know the most I've ever seen that vary? 2 inches. Now, I'm going to do something. I'm going to close his space envelope. Now, pay attention, Bill. How's that make you feel?
Not bad.
Not bad. 3 inches makes him feel real. How do you feel? About ready to back up. See, the next thing, if I say, "Ben, don't move," then Ben will probably be going to do just start doing this. You see? Okay, Ben, thank you. Now, I said American males are the same height. What happens if it's taller than I am, if the guy's taller than I am? Who's 6 foot or more? You are. How about helping me? If you would, you come over here. And this time I'm going to decide. Is that all right? Because I'm the one who's intimidated, see?
Yeah.
And if he were to come up to an arm's length, my arm's length, 4 to 6 inches, I'm uncomfortable with that. You know why? There's several things. First, the first thing I'd want to do is probably come about right here. Did you notice how I did that? I had both feet in place, and when I'm uncomfortable, I simply took one foot and moved it and just rocked back. Now, if I go, see, that's giving a message, you know, and you begin to wonder. But I don't want to look up like this either, you see. There's an intimidation factor the big guy has to the little guy, and the way you cool that is give a little bit more space. Thank you. I wanted you to see the difference. Now, I focused on American males, and I made that absolutely clear. Why haven't I said American females? They're different. Are they closer or further apart?
Closer.
Does everybody agree with that?
I think height has to do with it, though.
Well, what the women, first off, to all you women, one or two of you were silent. Do you really agree that you like closer space envelope than that? See, what I found is that some women really do like a closer space envelope, but some do not. Some like a broadened space envelope, especially at first meeting. And they don't like to... Now, if you wouldn't mind, you're the closest here. Let me demonstrate an issue. When I meet a lady, and I'll let you... if you'll take the space, and I'm coming up, and I'm going to be introduced, I'll stop outside of her space envelope. See, that's significantly... And if we're introduced, without my glasses, you're going to have to help me now.
Bev.
Hi, Bev, I'm Bill.
Hi, Bill.
And if you stick out your hand, see, I want her to stay there. I moved into her space envelope. Did you see that? Now look her in the eye and say, hi, Bev. Then I'll probably back out of her space envelope. Now,
and I'll probably step in.
That was exactly what will happen. That's exactly what will happen. If she is uncomfortable, she will step in. Now, see, she just closed the space envelope. She was a little closer than an arm's length and 46 inches. Now, I had suspected that already by her nonverbal feedback. She's given me very profound nonverbal feedback this morning. And if you'd have said, Bill, what percentage confidence do you have that she'll close the space envelope? I'd have said probably 90 or 95% because I picked up some personal characteristics that, incidentally, I admire. Thank you. But some ladies don't want that closed space envelope. And if you stop, you come in to shake hands and then move out of their space envelope, let them decide. Now, I suggest that's not a bad plan for men, even if the fellow's taller than I am. This one fellow came up to me at Georgia Power. He's 6'3", and he talked kind of low, and he talked far too loud. And he got right. I mean, he destroyed my space envelope. He's in there and he says, Bill, these men don't seem to be accepting me into the seminar. Do you think you could come up with any reasons why and maybe help? And I said, well, yeah, I really think that I could. You know, and we went, it's amazing that the guy, nobody had ever told him. He'd never heard the principle of the closed space envelope. He didn't know about a gruff voice. And to give the 5 minutes here, and I do want to do that, let me just tell you five things I found communications-wise that will reduce the tension, will take intensity away from your personal communication. Say you're communicating one-on-one, this will also work in a group. If you see that the group is responding, and with feeling some type of intensity, and you're not sure why. You see the setting? You don't know if it's what you said or didn't say or whatever went on. You're just feeling that they are feeling some type of intensity from you. Okay, that's the suggestion there. Five things. Pause. Now, that doesn't count. The pause gives you a chance to think about it. I'm going to suggest that you probably go ahead and increase your space envelope. You can do it like that, and then the next time if you go to the right side, if it's a group, you see I increase the space envelope 2 feet. That's one. Secondly, second thing, reduce the pitch. So when you get excited, you tend to talk like that. And then when you're more relaxed, your voice tends to drop down. So now if you're real gruff, of course, I don't know, you may not be aware of that. So you may have to just kind of soften that. But you lower the pitch, speak more softly. Don't speak quite so loudly. It's amazing. See if you're going to get personal. See, if I really wanted to get personal up here, I'd probably talk a little softer. If I wanted to project to the back of the room, it seems kind of weird, doesn't it? It makes you feel a little bit under stress, doesn't it? Yeah. See, goodness, that makes me feel under stress. Yeah, he's going to block the space envelope. That was a good nonverbal. That's the way I made him feel. And that's what I was looking for. So we talked about increase the space envelope, lower the pitch, speak more softly, and speak a little slower. Don't rush the words. And the fifth thing you do is smile. You simply smile. Not a Louis Armstrong now. I mean, that may look weird. That's too strange. But, you know, if you just a friendly smile. Just kind of crack the edges of the jaw there a little bit. That's not tough to do. And it'll take the tension right off of it. In most cases, if the guy's angry, then it probably won't. Then how do you do that? Well, you get soft and quiet, and you stay that way. Soft answer does what? Turns away wrath. You believe that? That's true. Okay, those are some things then that we could go. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a book that you could recommend that might teach that one?
Mm-hmm. No Nonsense Communication. And the reason I like it, he says almost identical things that I say, and you tend to like to have your own biases reinforced. So I really like the book. You know, I wish you hadn't asked me that. I can't remember the author. Sorry. I think maybe it's buried in here somewhere. I've got it, but I can't get to it right now. So from a standpoint of communication, we start off that we commit this whole matter to God. That our speech is our conversation to be always with grace. And you continue to pray that throughout your life. And pray about the little things that come up. Don't try to do this just by gutting it out. When something happened and you don't understand it, say, Lord, please help me. Teach me what to do with this. Show me how to respond to it. When Ewell up here suggested that he wanted to share a model with us, and I said, Lord, where should I put this? Should I interrupt this now or put this at the end? And the best response I got to that was, let's do it now in about half a minute. So and I'm giving him warning so he can be prepared. Those types of patterns, be aware of the barriers and let them work for you, not against you. Be aware that the impact comes from the nonverbal. And as you work on that, ask for feedback. You know the best person to give you feedback, in my estimation? If you're married, it's probably your sweetheart, your spouse. And then be sensitive to listen. I mean, pay attention to what that one says. Now, let's go ahead and give you all a chance here. I think we've got we've got three colors to choose from and a blank transparency. So I surrender here.
Okay, this is a model that I picked up in taking a counseling session. And this, I found out or summarized that it applies to all areas of life and the different goals. Let's say marriage, the goal is happiness. Child raising is obedience. Christian disciple making is to be a disciple, disciple making. Work is to excel in work and so forth. Okay. And the basis, I was trying to tie that in with communication. And the model is a pyramid, and the foundation of everything is communication. Okay, before we get there, there are certain steps that we have to go through. Of course, the basis communication. The next step is, before we can accept, or before we can understand someone, so that's understanding, we have to communicate. Before we accept or accept someone or acceptance or accept what they said, you have to understand. Okay, before you can trust, you have to have the base of these. And then this is the goal, which is, let's say, in children would be obedience, in marriage is happiness, and in old life it would be peace with God, and disciple making is to be a disciple.
Very good. Thank you. Now, may I capitalize on that for motivation? That if we really want to proceed up the
fellowship between trust and the goal of fellowship. The fellowship right there before you get to the top. Or on a personal basis, if you want to use it more on a secular, you could call it self-actualization.
Is based upon Maslow's Maslow's hierarchy of human needs. He capitalized on the pattern that Maslow has identified earlier. But I think this is shows us a foundation stone for communication. It's the basis for our relationships. Yeah. And if it's not effective and not strong, it's going to be difficult for us. Now, I want to give you one last invitation. If any of you were interested in the idea of tent making, the possibility of using a profession to get overseas, there's 4 million Americans working overseas. So there's no shortage of jobs. And almost any profession is probably some type of employment. If you're willing to teach English Then there's jobs, teaching conversational English. You just have to be willing to do that. If you have a degree in some field, phys ed, home ec, or whatever, and are willing to teach English, it gets you a little higher level job. And when I say jobs are available, I could get 50 jobs in Red China right by telephone call if you were willing to teach English and had a degree in any field. And you know how many takers I'm getting for that? Among our own staff and my own people that have applied for this program, about a half of 1%. It's not a thing that we have to wonder about. It is there waiting. The Red Chinese are pleading for our English teachers to come over and teach them English. And they would rather have a committed Christian than have a non-Christian. How does that strike you? Why? Yes, sir. And what does the value system say? That you are not a liar, a cheat, a thief. You're not going to be a drunkard. You're not going to be arrogant and demanding. And you're not going to chase the ladies up and down the streets. The Chinese don't go for that. No culture goes for that. And Americans are infamous for it. If you're interested, I'm going to hang around. Then I'm going to go to lunch along with you. If somebody would like to talk to me about that or anything we've said or haven't said, I'll be happy to listen. Thank you for sharing with us the model, Ewan. Lord, we do thank you for giving us the capability to speak, that you showed us about words in your word. You said that your word would not come back to you void, that you would do with it whatever you please, that Jesus Christ is the word made flesh. Lord, that's staggering. The power involved in words is overwhelming. I would pray that you would help us in our own speech to be, our conversation would be with grace, seasoned with salt.